if you're a long-term investor, there's lots and lots and lots of running room. It wouldn't surprise me if this market needed a rest when the junior market says they're undercapitalized and where I get cut back in every financing I try to participate in. The fact that high-profile investors get cut back tells me that this industry isn't as short of finance as they would like to convince themselves to believe. But the fundamentals around precious metals investments, as an example, I think continue very much intact. The big, beautiful bill, or that big, bad budget buster, depending on your point of view, I think is symptomatic of the problems that face US dollar hegemony, and hence very bullish for gold.
Rick Rule, good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing very well, the better for being on and continuing our conversation. Thank you.
I want to start out with the last interview that we dropped. It was so long ago, it was about a week ago. And I got an interesting comment on there that I want to read to you, and if you could address that. But I'd also like to give my two cents first, but if you could address it, I'd love to hear what you have to say. Steve R6810 asks, Rick says he had huge success in war zones with corrupt regimes. I would love to hear him discuss whether he thinks about the consequences of investing in lawless regimes for local people and the environment. And if I could just briefly give my two cents, is I think that's a very valid and good question, but I think you need to break that down to be helpful, if you would. The first thing is what government, what jurisdiction is not corrupt? And if you think of North America here, that's not corrupt, you have one thing coming to you. I would even argue it's as corrupt, if not more, than many of the second and third world that we invest in. The second thing is I look at the value I'm giving to a company that employs people, and how do you change a regime that's in a country, and this is somewhat romantic, you change it one person at a time by giving them job and giving them resources. I can go a lot further, but I want to get to you and your thoughts on that question, Rick.
I think you've summed up the correct point of view. I might go further, and this is not to apologize. But the truth is that the world is politicized, and I would argue that the political process is corrupt. Let's suppose you're anti-war. What nation in the world has the largest defense budget, larger than the next 11 countries combined? What nation defends itself in 100 foreign countries, which is to say, deploys troops in 100 foreign countries? When people talk about environmental destruction and they talk about, as an example, carbon generation, in the United States, we prefer to set carbon quotas on a nation per nation basis. In smaller countries, they prefer to do it on a per capita basis. So, by that standard, the countries with the best so-called emissions records have the worst emissions records if you base it on a per capita. Of course, emerging countries with regards to environmental degradation would suggest, with regards to carbon, that since 90-something percent of the carbon loadings are historic, that the countries that have contributed to those historic loads are the countries that should bear the bet, should bear the brunt of environmental restoration. The point is simply that the government that is potentially the most destructive to you and your values is the government closest to you. It is odd that, and I'm just going to say it, Andy, people like you and I fear corruption, but we don't seem to fear corruption when it occurs in English, according to the rule of law enforced by the legislature, by white people. We fear corruption that we understand less with different skin pigments. What is the difference, really, qualitatively, between a campaign contribution and a bribe? I would suggest that one is sanctioned by law and the other is sanctioned by process. So while I understand the nature of the questioner's concerns, I would suspect that the questioner would be better off looking at the sins of one's own regime as opposed to externalizing blame. I also believe that engagement is a very good thing. I believe, irrespective of how the United States gets along with the Chinese or the Iranians or the Russians or anybody, that we're better off talking than shooting. And I certainly believe that, as an example, my small engagement in Congo, or South Sudan, or Cambodia, or Uzbekistan, all the questionable places that I have invested in, has probably been a larger contributor to peace and stability in those regions than my absence would have been. I understand, as an example, that a group of us made a discovery in Syria, which we mercifully sold to the Indians, and then it was taken over by ISIS. And a lot of that money went to a bad cause. One needs to decide whether you are wholly conversant and wholly comfortable as to what happens to the taxes that you pay in your own country. How does that further world peace? Does it further world peace, or does it in fact further instability?
You gave a speech, and it was really one of the best speeches of the year. I didn't know it at the time, but just upon reflection, is about that the time is now for natural resource stocks and to be an investor. And it's right now. And that was in January. And boy, have we had a year, regardless of the various fluctuations within the markets. Where are we at now? And then, give me your thoughts.
Depends on who you are. If you're a contrarian trader who followed one part of my speech, which is to say that things are hated when they're cheap, the time has come to sell. If you owned a basket of small uranium stocks because people hated them, people don't hate them anymore. They've doubled, in some cases tripled. The hate's gone. Sell the stock. If you're a long-term investor, there's lots and lots and lots of running room. It wouldn't surprise me if this market needed a rest when the junior market says they're undercapitalized, and where I get cut back in every financing I try to participate in. The fact that high-profile investors get cut back tells me that this industry isn't as short of finance as they would like to convince themselves to believe. But the fundamentals around precious metals investments, as an example, I think continue very much intact. The big beautiful bill, or that big bad budget buster, depending on your point of view, I think is symptomatic of the problems that face U.S. dollar hegemony, and hence very bullish for gold. I think 3 decades of underinvestment in natural resources, in productive capacity around natural resources, is very good for a whole variety of natural resource investments. I don't suspect that we're going to have a full-blown resource market until we decide whether or not we're going to have a recession, or in fact have that recession. I continue to believe that the near-term prospects of things like copper and nickel and oil, industrial materials, could easily be impacted by a global economic slowdown. I'm no economist. I don't know if we're going to have one. But it wouldn't surprise me if we had weaker markets in natural resources for a couple of years before we have stronger markets. Make no mistake, a few years out, 3 decades of underinvestment in productive capacity is going to come home to roost. And we're going to have very, very, very strong natural resource markets. So I think, in answer to the question, it depends on who you are. The
Okay.
moves that we've seen in the period 2024 to 2025 in the companies that were at the Real Symposium, the admittedly a fairly select group of juniors, those companies year on year were uniformly up 50%. Much of it had to do not so much with huge buying power, but the absence of sellers. And you know, that one's over. So if you're a trader, be happy. Wait for another period of hate. If you're an investor, the analog to what we're in right now, I believe, is the decade of the 1970s. It's an extremely powerful analog. Familiarize yourself with the fact that during that decade, there was at least one period, 1975, where the price of natural resource stocks fell by half. Half in 9 months. If you didn't have the courage of your convictions and you got shaken out, in terms of, as an example, the gold trade, you left a move from $100 an ounce to $850 an ounce out of your portfolio over 6 short years. So think about the answer to that question in the context of the analog of the decade of the 1970s. Study how that market played out for 10 years and plot to live your life accordingly. There will be volatility, there will be risk. But for people who understand the nature of the game and take risks that they can afford, this is going to be a very rewarding 10 years, and a 10 years where other aspects of investing might be substantially less pleasant.
To all my viewers and listeners here, Rick and I are going to be going through my list here and my list of companies. We're going to be talking about the companies that were very appealing to me. I met most of these companies. I've talked to most of the CEOs, and I've already started doing my due diligence them. They were all at the 2025 Rick Rule Symposium, the Rule Symposium in Boca Raton. I am an investor in some, and when I will preface this with Rick, if I once I ask the company, I will t let him know that I'm an investor or not. That all being said, I last interview I told Rick some of these companies were up significantly at the conference. I would not chase. This is not a recommendation, but if any company's up after this talk, that is not my motivation. But and I would suggest not chasing. Let stuff come to you. And just really have this as a resource to start developing your lists so you can do your own due diligence. Rick, tell me before we get into the list of companies, tell me how about how if investors want to email you, how you review their portfolios and
Sure. Any investor or speculator who cares what I think about natural resource stocks can personalize it. Go to ruleinvestmentmedia.com and list your natural resource stocks. Sidebar, no crypto, no pot stocks, no tech stocks, just natural resource stocks. I'll review them 1 to 10. Understand that these rankings are snapshots in time. Things can change very rapidly with news. And I'll comment on individual issues if I think my comments might have value. Remember that these are indicative, that circumstances change. One drill hole could make me look like a genius or make me look like a moron. So the fact that I said something nice about something in August doesn't mean I won't say something nasty about it in November. So understand that these are snapshots in time, but they are valuable snapshots in time. We spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in data acquisition and analysis, and it's all yours for free at ruleinvestmentmedia.com.
And I've taken advantage of that with you. So, just to all my viewers and listeners, I strongly, strongly advise. I will say advise. Take advantage of Rick and let him review your portfolio. So let's start out with my listing. And this was compiled through the talks that I had and the meetings that I had at the conference. And number one I have is Concora Copper with Jeff Phillips. They were at the conference and I believe they presented. I was not at that presentation. Give me your thoughts on Concora Copper.
Concora is a small prospect generator, meaning that they use their technical acumen and other people's money to explore for large copper deposits. They're Australian domiciled, and the prospect generator methodology is even less popular in Australia than it is here, which is one of the reasons why I like it. Statistically, using your brains and other people's money is the best possible exploration technology, and prospect generation over 4 decades has made me really a stupendous amount of money relative to the broad market. I like Kincora because major companies like Kincora, they have attracted third-party investments from very large companies, which means that those large companies have done some of the due diligence that I whether otherwise would have had to have done, and they're better at it than I am. This being Kincora is suitable for investors who take the long-term point of view and are willing to take not just the relative, but also the absolute risk with regards to exploration. I happen to be one of those.
Okay, great. The second company I have is Ecora Resources. And let me give you my thoughts quickly. I love the two things about them that I love. I love that they're a royalty company, and I love that they're in critical minerals. I love the, and I want exposure to both. As of right now, I am not an investor. That very well could change in the coming weeks. I had an opportunity to talk to Mark Bishop LaFleche. I hope I get that name right. What also one thing I really love about them is that they have assets that are money coming in. They're cash flowing a lot, and I just see them as significantly undervalued. What's your thoughts on Ecora?
I would agree with that. I am particularly attracted to their pipeline of royalties that are not producing but will be producing in short order. The knock against them is that their primary royalty revenue has been from coal. They've used that coal cash flow to diversify amongst other royalties. The coal revenue is falling. But that coal ore body is out of sequence right now, and I suspect that the coal revenues will increase again. I look at Ecora as a sum of the parts. I think it has traded poorly because the royalty model is not as well known in Great Britain, where they're domiciled, or Australia, where they are listed. And it isn't popular in the United States because of its foreign domicile. So the poor relative share price is explained by structure. I am very much a value guy, and I like the fact that the whole is trading at a discount to the value of the sum of the parts. But I also like the fact that they have a very good track record over 10 years deploying cash flow, their recycle ratio. The amount of assets that they generate per dollar of revenue that they get from their existing assets is very high. And I think there's a good investment allocation discipline there, one that will serve them well, I suspect, for a decade.
The other one that I have is another royalty company, Empress Royalty. I had spent a lot of time there at the symposium with Alexandra. I was very impressed with her presence, in the sense of just not only how she handled herself in the way during my interview with her, I was really playing hardball and very critical with her. With me, she hit it out of the park that I felt. They've also started cash flowing, and it looks like they're projecting to cash flow a lot more. Those are my thoughts. Tell me your thoughts on Empress.
She's a relatively young woman who's been in the resource business for over 30 years, pardon me. She started working for her dad, who is a friend of mine and a legend in the business, when she was 14 years of age. She has access, despite her small market capitalization, to the people at Endeavor Financial. So she has a durable competitive advantage in deal flow, which is unusual in the royalty space. She doesn't participate in competitive bidding because she doesn't have to. As a consequence of Endeavor, she gets there first, often in small or private companies. I wouldn't suggest that she is undervalued any longer. She has done a very good job of explaining her message to her constituency and delivering. But I would suggest that she is at the fulcrum point. She is at the point, she is at the place now where she has the scale to participate in larger royalties. She has the distribution network to acquire those royalties, and she has the ability now to raise the capital, either on balance sheet or off balance sheet, to fund those royalties. She's really at a place where her franchise is ready to blossom. There's a saying in many industries, but it's particularly appropriate in natural resources, that you work a decade to be an overnight success. She's ready now.
That was the one, I don't want to say the one, but one of the companies that I mentioned last week that I didn't tell you about that was running away from me at the symposium. That was one of them because I wanted to buy them so much and then they just started running away there. So I'm waiting. They are on my list. I am not an investor yet, but that will more likely change if it comes back to a price point that I like. Let me just talk about Homeland Uranium here. Roger Lemet, I met him. He had a fantastic background in the industry, or been doing this for 20 plus years, if you would. I really am bullish on uranium moving forward, even though we can certainly have a sell-off. Tell me about Homeland Uranium.
Very early on, this is extremely high risk. This is a wonderful idea packed around a good guy with good backers. But you need a lot more data with this thing. I own a reasonable bit of it because I, like you, am attracted to uranium. I'm attracted to the exploration potential of their ground for many reasons, not least of which a geologist, Brent Cook, who used to work for me, cut his teeth on this ground, and he's attracted to it. So I have access to information that, while not insider information, is information that's unavailable to many people. It's important to note, however, that these theses are unproven. You're taking very, very, very high risk here. One outcome may be that we're wrong, in which case you lose half your money. A different outcome may be that you're right, in which case you make 10 times your money. Making 10 times your money is an awful lot of fun. I've had the good fortune to do it a few times, but losing half your money is not fun at all. So in assessing Homeland Uranium, familiarize yourself with the uranium thesis. Decide for yourself whether the policy change in the United States from having uranium to being an anathema to having it be a commodity that's going to be subsidized is something that can that continues. And then decide for yourself whether you can stomach the risk involved in sole risk exploration, because it's high.
I really like that you brought that up. And to all my viewers and listeners, I look at three different models, if you would, in the Lassonde curve. This is very early Lassonde curve, but that's what I really like because these, as you mentioned, have the potential to be 10 baggers. But again, there's significant risk involved where you can lose half, if not all, of everything. But I like to structure my portfolio with these kinds of companies, deep value that I see in the middle. And then companies that are either going into production or production. So I'm glad that you mentioned this. This is early stage Lassonde curve.
Two people that I've worked close with over time, Eric Sprott and Doug Casey, both suggest that a substantial part of a portfolio could be constructed of 10 or more uncorrelated circumstances where your downside's 50% and your upside's 1,000%, because one 10 for one amortizes an awful lot of 50% losses. Both gentlemen have pointed that out. I think it's important, however, that investors need to have both the financial and the psychological staying power to avail themselves of that circumstance. If you yourself aren't capable, both psychologically and financially, of staying the trade, there's no particular reason over time where that performance dispersal curve is consistent, which means that your 10 bagger could occur in year 8, while your losers could occur in years 1, 2, 3, and 4. And it's very difficult psychologically to stay the trade when you're feeling the pain rather than feeling the reward. So people need to be self-honest before they adopt that speculative methodology. My wife jokes that all the money that I now invest conservatively, I made speculating wildly. And she's correct. But I have a temperament that may not be ubiquitous among your listeners.
That is great advice, and it's really know yourself and know and everybody that comes in this space or even and in any other space that you're investing in, they're always something they'll all say something. I've done it myself, but then the reality hits and they're not that way. So you really have to do some soul searching and I think also just writing things down and having a plan. So well said. The next one I have is First Majestic here. This was a producer. I've traded in and out of First Majestic for several years now. I'm a big fan of Keith Neumeyer. Tell me about First Majestic and what are your thoughts? I love the high leverage play to silver and it's lower risk, I think, due to just that it's producing and where I think silver is going to go. Just my two cents.
The investor in me has two nervousnesses about First Majestic. One is Jarrett Canyon, where they've made a big commitment, and so far they've been wrong. The second is that the recent free cash flow growth has come about through the acquisition of an asset with a fairly short reserve life index. So if they're unsuccessful reinvesting this free cash flow, before you know it, this cash flow will be gone. I happen to believe that the short reserve life of this index, of this asset, will be addressed by very aggressive exploration drilling. In other words, I think there's more silver there than is carried on the balance sheet, but I could easily be wrong. I own First Majestic, despite valuation concerns, because there's an off-balance sheet asset. Keith Neumeyer has invested in financial public relations for 15 years. He's probably got $100 million sunk in brand building. And there's a constituency of about 100,000 speculators in First Majestic who are unalloyed silver bulls. There is no constituency in the world that is voracious, as voracious in their appreciation of good information than existing shareholders. And if you have any good information, including information around a silver bull market, which I think is going to come, that constituency, the 100,000 retail shareholders of First Majestic First Majestic Silver, can be counted on being very aggressive participants. I've watched this stock run three times in the past, and when it runs, this off-balance sheet investment in a shareholder constituency, the response evidenced by that group is astonishing. You could regard this as an inefficient but leveraged silver call.
Yeah, well said. I would agree with everything you got. And I am one of those people that you mentioned. Next company I have is i80 Gold. We interviewed them there at the symposium. I had a chance to talk to them offline. I liked what I saw, but I want to know your thoughts.
i80's challenged. They have a great asset range. They're traditionally great explorers. But they have a pooched balance sheet. They have a management team that has experience with that, and they're going to address it. I own i80 because I think they stick handle their way through this. I also understand that the share price deterioration wasn't merely about their pooched balance sheet. It was also about the fact that one of the large shareholders, Equinox Gold, needed the cash. They sold the cash to sustain their own operations. Had they not sold the shares and diluted in Equinox, they would have suggested to the market that Equinox was worth less than i80. So I understand the reason for part of the share price decline, and I like the people and I like the asset. But make no mistake, there's a lot of balance sheet risk here. New people, rather than buying i80, might wait until the next equity financing, and there will be one, which is the refinancing transaction, then participate in that.
Okay, the next one I have is Integra Resources. Full disclosure, I am an investor in Integra. I first learned about Integra at the 24 Rural Symposium. I had a very nice return. I sold half of my position. I'm not patting myself on the back here. I'm just giving full disclosure. Since I've sold half of my position, they picked up a producing asset. In late 24, they're now in production. I was spent some time with George, very impressed with George, and I love that they're producing. What are your thoughts on Integra?
I'm a shareholder of Integra. I've been an investor in George Salamis' prior activities, going back 10 years. He's a highly competent guy, very honest guy, good communicator. Don't get me wrong, good salesman. But he also has a great history of success in mining. And I've seen that success conformably aligns. In other words, people who have been successful are more likely to be successful in the future. He's also focused on one thing. He's focused on revitalizing past producers in the U.S. Intermountain West or areas where there's production synergies. The mine that he bought from Argonaut in Lovelock, Nevada, is about 30 line miles away from two more mines that he hopes to put in production. It's highly likely that he will be able to utilize the staff and the equipment from Florida Canyon across the highway at the new location. And the other deposit, DeLamar, up in the Idaho, Oregon, Nevada sort of border, is a very large past producer, one I know fairly well from its Kinross days. And this is a mine that didn't shut down because it ran out of gold. This is a mine that shut down because of very, very, very low gold prices. And by the way, very low gold prices in a very different production technology scenario. Enhancements in recovery, as well as the gold price, I think augur well for this company. If I had a criticism, it's that it's a collection of tier two assets. There's no asset in this inventory that will be in the bottom of the cost quartile worldwide or the top of the return on capital employed, rankings worldwide. What you have, though, is a highly competent management team focused on a task that they understand, and one where the value of the whole, as expressed by the market cap, is much less than the value of the sum of the parts, with a realistic plan to beneficiate those assets. Very, very adult company.
Yeah, thank you. No, I'm very happy. And I usually don't regret selling my position at a profit. And I didn't sell everything by no means, I just have. But I actually somewhat regret that. So, looking for new entries, but also looking at other projects. Here's one for you. I am a new investor to this just recently, since the conference, Tectonic Metals, Tony Rita. I first found out about them at the conference in 24. They didn't really stand out to me there. And since then, they really have. I love their assets in Alaska. I love, it looks like they could potentially have a tier one asset if they don't have already in Alaska. I love that they're on native lands, if you would. And it looks like they keep on hitting on their drill holes. The downside of that is infrastructure. And I think that's more than likely going to be a challenge for them. But what are your thoughts on Tectonic?
I own Tectonic because I was a shareholder in Cameanac, and I got to watch Tony Rita assist Ira Thomas in building that company. And I have a high regard for him. I'm not usually a fan of sole risk exploration, and I'm less a fan of sole risk exploration in extremely high operating cost environments like rural Alaska. The idea that you have to fly in the helicopter fuel to fly the helicopters tells you something about how everything that you do in Nevada costs you four times as much in Alaska. I am interested in the fact that one of their exploration ideas appears to be bearing fruit. It's very early on, but there is an indicated discovery. We will tell, we will learn over the next year, how far it goes. This is one again where you need to do an audit of yourself before you spend an awful lot of time and treasure on Tectonic. If you aren't willing to accept absolute failure, if you aren't willing to endure very long news blackouts during the winter when nobody in their right mind would explore in central Alaska, if you aren't willing to accept all that, if you aren't willing to accept the fact that they're going to have to be large equity issuers every year to fund investment programs, this company isn't for you. If you are somebody like myself who has enjoyed the benefits of participating in a 5 million ounce or 10 million ounce discovery, and you understand that it can take 5 or 6 years of heartache and turmoil, this may be for you.
Got it. Okay. Next one I have is Revival Gold, Hugh Argo.
Yeah.
Spoke with him at the conference. Love the asset, love the jurisdiction. I'm trying to find, talk about that, but I'm also trying to find the holes in this project and this company.
Two assets there, Bear Track in Idaho, so a little bit of permitting risk there, and Merkur in Utah, probably no permitting risk. These are old producers, oxide producers that shut down. The idea is to revitalize both of them. And there'll be a couple challenges. We're in the boring part of the process now, where you're trying to arrange financing, you're trying to do permitting. Admittedly, the permitting climate in the Western U.S. is better than it used to be. And Utah is, in fact, a superb state for permitting. I'll just editorialize right now. I would love to see Integra and Merkur merge. They are involved in the same business. They're both high quality people. The idea that you could combine two companies and eliminate 35% of the duplicate overheads, I think would be a wonderful set of circumstances. But both guys want to be boss, so it's unlikely to happen. I own it really because of outstanding leverage to gold. These deposits are both economic, I believe, at $2,400 gold. Pardon me, $3,400 gold. But I'm a believer that we're going to see higher gold prices, and I believe that the gold prices will increase faster than the cost of producing gold will increase, which is to say, I believe that margins are going to increase. You have two deposits, one of which Merkur may be a fairly big deposit. These deposits are well understood. There's reasonable, I say reasonable infrastructure. The Idaho asset has kind of lousy infrastructure. 14 miles of Forest Service road. Mercor has very, very good infrastructure, and these are very well-known deposits, leveraged to higher gold prices, which I think we're going to see. And in the hands of a guy who's a mining guy, he's not. It's not like he dropped down into this business from baking bread or something.
They were really on my short list, if you would. Again, very impressed with the asset. And again, I thank you. I was trying to poke holes in them. Latin Metals, Keith Henderson, I had an opportunity to sit down and talk with them. It looks like they are just coming into their own right now. Tell me about Latin Metals and what are your thoughts?
Again, a prospect generator. They're looking for copper gold deposits. The guy's history is successful exploration for copper gold deposits in the Andean corridor. I mean, he's doing what he's done for 30 years. A measure of his historical success is the fact that he, when he generates a project, is almost always able to sell it to a major mining company. Which means that the due diligence is done for you by the Newmonts and the Anglos of the world, which is a very good thing. The bad news is that prospect generation takes time. The news flow is controlled by the guy who spends the money. If the guy who spends the money is Anglo, or Glencore or Rio, they care less about proper news flow to maintain a market than you do, and that's beyond your control. The good news is that you get access to their expertise for free, and you take the risk with their money rather than your money. The consequence of that is that the leverage to exploration success among prospect generators is absolutely huge. I particularly like prospect generators who are exploring for tier one deposits, which is to say deposits with in excess of $10 billion in in-situ recoverable reserves and resources in tier one terrain. And the Andean Cordillera, be it Peru, Chile, or Argentina, is certainly tier one terrain. And that's what these guys are looking for. They're swinging for the fences with other people's money.
Well, here's another prospect generator for you. It's Riverside Resources. It's actually, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not only a prospect generator, but it's also has royalties company. I had spent a lot of time, not a lot of time, but a good amount of time with John Mark Stoud. Very impressed with him. He runs a very tight ship, I thought. But yeah, give me your thoughts on them.
They are a prospect generator, and he's unique. Unique in the sense that he ran new business development for both BHP and Teck, which is to say that he was his primary customer. The business of a prospect generator is to develop exploration concepts which they sell to other mining companies, preferably major. And his job for the 20 years before he founded Riverside was to be the customer. To buy projects that were offered up by juniors. So he knows his customer very, very, very well. He's a very bright guy. I would note that he hasn't enjoyed exploration success yet, but I have received more benefit from companies that Riverside has formed and spun off over the last 15 years than I paid for the stock. I haven't sold any stock. And I've more than recovered my capital by selling off the dividend distributions of the companies that he's formed over the last 15 years. So you could think of them as a merchant bank as well as being a prospect generator. Think about forming and spinning off for free four public companies, which enables then your shareholders, if they want, to sell off the shares of the distributed companies, as opposed to selling off the shares of the prospect generator, which generated the wealth to begin with, which is what I've done.
Okay, got it. Last one I have here. I am an investor in this is West Red Lake Gold. I just so you know, I fun story. I went to their luncheon at the conference and talked to Shane there. And I've talked to Shane several times, and the team that they have there. They seem to be coming into their own right now. They're producing right now, and it looks like they're going to really they're ramping it up as we speak. But fun story. I was walking back to my seat in the back of the room to listen, and there was Frank Gustra, and I sat down next to him, And I just introduced myself to him, and he flattered me. He says, "Andy Millett, I know who you are." But I got to talk to Frank, not talk, but I got to listen to him before the talk and afterwards, just to pick his brain. And that's really the beauty of the conference, is just following these billionaires or close to billionaires around, picking their brain. And boy, did he give me a lot of insight. So that's my story about Frank Gustra. But tell me about West Red Lake.
I'm a West Red Lake shareholder, and I have been one since Frank led the recapitalization of the former failed effort. I'm an indirect shareholder too. We, meaning Sprott, were lenders to the prior unsuccessful effort. So we became a large West Red Lake shareholder as a consequence of a former failed effort. I'm very fond of Shane. I'm also very fond personally of Gwen Preston, who does the corporate development in IR. I've known Gwen first as a journalist with the Northern Miner, then as an independent newsletter writer, now in IR for a long time, and I have a high regard for her. And I have had every possible relationship with Frank Giustra. He's been a customer of mine. I've been a customer of his. More commonly, we were competitors for 40 years. I have a very high regard for Frank. I like everything about West Red Lake, except for the fact that they have proceeded to production without the production of a bankable feasibility study. Gwen says they don't need to, that the deposit's been studied to death, that the best way to study it is to mine it. I get all that. She also says that they have completed what is in effect a bankable feasibility study internally. I'd prefer to see an external one. So I am a shareholder. I think I'm a ha happy shareholder, but I'm on pins and needles. I've seen this happen five times in the past. It's happening with another one of my lar very large holdings. What's the name of that thing? Emerald Resources, an Australian company that was a participant at the conference. They aren't doing bankable feasibility studies because they're funding their new mines with the free cash flow from their old mines. I hate major investments without third-party verification.
To all my viewers and listeners, my internet went out, and so I'm doing this from my phone. But Rick, you were talking about a feasibility study. They did an internal feasibility study at West Red Lake, and you prefer the more official public, if you would, feasibility study.
I like third-party verification and validation. I really cut my teeth in this business as a lender. I remain a risk manager despite the fact that I'm a speculator to this day. And I would rather pay up for certainty, personally. I would have preferred that they delayed commencing production, that they endured the additional year of overhead, and that they preferred a, that they prepared, pardon me, a verified, validated third-party testimonial called a bankable feasibility study. And I sincerely hope that Frank, in some interview 5 years from now, can say, you know, Rick was too conservative. He recommended that we waste $20 million and instead we made $100 million. I'd love to be wrong.
Got it. That's the all I have on my list. Let's talk real quick about the Rural Classroom, the value added there, and that I am a member of the online community.
Well, yeah, there's a couple layers to what I do that might be useful to your people. The first, of course, is Rural Investment Media, where we rank natural resource stocks. If that's a value to you, we encourage people to go to the Rural Classroom, ruralclassroom.com. There are 14,000 members there who take advantage of lots of free instructional material, introduction to natural resource investing being one, to discussion groups, to lots of interviews, to weekly question and answer sessions involving myself every Thursday, or at least every Thursday I'm in town. And every 90 days, we do a very deep dive into one particular topic around natural resource investing. This is not free. We charge you $99 for it. Of course, like every other investing product I have, if you don't feel like you got your money's worth, just tell me, I give you your money back. But you also have to invest more than $99. These are 8 hour long deep dives. Andy, you've been there. They are deep dives.
Yep.
If you're the type of person who buys the Sunday paper to read the funnies and do the crosswords, don't come. We work you extremely hard. If you're the kind of person who's a self-actualized investor and wants to learn more about uranium or more about silver or more about prospect generators or more about the capital stack in mining companies, by all means, attend the boot camp. Our upcoming boot camp is part three of a three-part series on gold. Our topics, by the way, are decided by our audience. We let the Rule Classroom audience tell us what the boot camps are going to be about. The first part of the gold session was gold as a topic and gold as a commodity, telling you why you would or would not own gold in a portfolio, how you go about acquiring physical gold or the gold proxies, you know, the gold trusts or the gold ETFs. The second was about the major gold companies, the golden triumvirate, as I call them, the three best gold mining companies in the world, Wheaton, Franco, and Agnico Eagle. The third is going to be about the rest of the gold mining companies, in particular, the juniors, the single asset producers, the developers, the explorers. That's coming up. Gold bull markets traditionally follow very predictable patterns led by gold, going then to the best of the best, then the best of the rest, and then on the value train. The next gold boot camp will tell you how to speculate in the gold juniors. It's more useful in conjunction with having attended the first two boot camps. You could attend those retroactively. The recordings are for sale. The information is timeless. And we will move on to other paid products, other paid educational products, including boot camps from the Rural Classroom. The two that are foremost in my mind is that we're working right now with the Colorado School of Mines to do a four-day course on securities analysis and valuation in mining. In other words, try to teach people over 4 days how to tell the difference between what something is selling for and what it's worth. This will make the boot camps look like child's play. This will be very, very, very tough work. And it'll only be suitable for people who are professional or semi-professional speculators or people who are total freaks, like I am, about mining industry valuation. In addition to that, we hope to institute a product of the Rural Classroom modeled after Shark Tank, which is where we allow a company who believes they're genuinely undervalued to come onto our show to prove it. We're going to force them to pay a fee to do this. But the idea is that rather than enduring a 12 or 15 minute page view, the companies will come on live, they'll do the page view, and then they'll be subjected to an hour's worth of scrutiny, not hostile scrutiny, but actual scrutiny by myself and a panel of real investors, people who will buy stock based on the outcome of the interview if it's good. And after that, we would propose to open it up to the paying members of the Rural Classroom to conduct their own investigation, all live stream. If a company is legitimately undervalued, it may be, given that 3,000 to 5,000 people would watch that interview, that that one interview would eliminate over 6 weeks the undervaluation. If by contrast, the company did a bad job at the interview, that company may never raise money again. The whole process, Andy, of going into people's boardroom and having them explain to me why I should buy their stock has been very interesting and very amusing for me over time. And I want to share the interest and the drama of that live, via live stream at the Rural Classroom. We will charge for this. It's likely that we will charge the companies $20,000 or $25,000. It's likely that we will charge the attendees a nominal sum, $19 to $25. We will distribute to the attendees links to the company's website and links to their SEDAR or EDGAR filings, so that the attendees can arrive already armed with looking at the balance sheet and the income statement. It's intended by us that the attendees, not as a required prerequisite, but as an intelligent prerequisite, familiarize themselves with the valuation lessons taught at the Rural Classroom, in particular, Introduction to Natural Resource Investing, where, among other things, we have an hour-long video about how to interrogate mining company managers. In other words, ideally, 3,000 people would show up who were prepared for the interview, who could do a good job in asking intelligent questions and sharing the benefit of those questions with the rest of the audience. So it's a product that we're running by the regulators right now to make sure that, by doing the right thing, we don't inadvertently violate any laws.
I love the idea. Count me in. Count me in.
Great.
Love the idea. It's fantastic. Rick, you got to go. I want to thank you so much for your time. To all my viewers and listeners, you got a treat today. So just thank you so much, and we'll see you again very soon.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you for your support of and attendance at the Natural Resources Investment Conference. We enjoyed having you there.
It's my pleasure. Take care.